Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations. This is episode 9 on one of the key texts of Hawthorne Studies, The Social Problems of an Industrial Civilization by Elton Mayo. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. As always, we are grateful to the Innovation, Knowledge and Organizational Networks Research Center for helping us bring you this episode. My name is Dimitris, coming to you from Birmingham in the United Kingdom.
This is Pedro, coming to you from New York City.
And this is Ralph, coming to you from Albuquerque, New Mexico, 1,600 meters above sea level.
Very specific, thank you.
Yeah, I love that.
So, Pedro's back.
Hey!
Yes, welcome back, Pedro.
Thank you.
Yes, how did you settle in New York? We were speculating over the previous episodes where you are and what you're up to.
Very well, thank you. I'm visiting NYU here, and it took some, you know, effort to find a place to live and everything, but now I managed to settle down and, you know, get my space and everything. So I'm doing very well, loving the city and getting to do some interesting work.
Fantastic. Elton Mayo and the famous Hawthorne Studies. So the book that we read is second book on the studies. The first one was entitled The Human Problems of an Industrial Civilization. This one is The Social Problems. One of the reasons we picked this text is because this version is available online so that you can read with us or scan through if you wish. So the Hawthorne Studies, which were conducted by Elton Mayo and Fritz Rothlinsberger, I hope I pronounced it correctly, they did a series of studies in 1920s with the workers at the Hawthorne plant of the Western Electric Company, where they emphasized socio-psychological aspects of human behavior in organizations. So you will note this is yet another key work in management coming out of the 1920s, 1930s. And actually, you will find that Chester Barnard, whom we discussed at length over the previous two episodes, knew Elton Mayo and was partially inspired by Mayo's work. Similarly, Elton Mayo references Chester Barnard extensively in the first half of the book, so it's an interesting interplay going on there. So Hawthorne researchers hypothesized that things like choosing your co-workers and working as a group and being treated special or perhaps contemporarily, we would call this normal, and having sympathetic supervisors, things like that, would increase productivity. And after a bit of, quite a bit of research, they did actually show that. Equally suggesting that more traditional for their time incentives such as money have a very limited effect. Basically, if you listened or read Barnard, you'll find that much of what Elton Mayo and colleagues are saying is what Barnard said, except that these guys are providing extensive empirical evidence and argumentation to support their points, whereas Barnard was largely drawing on his personal experience. So this is a broad overview of what's going on here, and I suppose it's worth giving a more specific outline of this particular text.
Well, and Mayo addresses many issues. It's a very wide-ranging book. He certainly addresses the Hawthorne studies. He has other studies that he talks about from a textile plant. And I think it's worth pointing out that some of the findings from the Hawthorne studies that we learned about when we first studied it are not quite the way Mayo covers them. So this idea that the investment by the supervisor into the employees and working focusing on their morale and incentives and more control of work, those were surprising outcomes. They actually didn't expect that. And there's the classic case of the, which we can get into later, where they were adjusting the lights up and down and found out that even when they adjusted the lights up, production went up, and when they adjusted them down, production went down. And so that was very surprising to them. And one of the things Mayo talks about is the importance of gaining deep familiarity, or what he calls knowledge of acquaintance, with the subject matter and material at hand. So that caused them to do what they call the interview studies. And so there's a lot of information in the book about the Hawthorne interview studies. And Mayo also has a critique of social science, economics, and law and political science, because he makes the argument that they're not in the details of the data enough to justify the conclusions or theories that they use. So he gives some examples of that. So Dimitris made a very good point. There is more basis in empirical data, although Mayo summarizes it greatly in this text. So it looks, the text reads as if he's trying to reach a wider audience because he doesn't go into all the studies, but there's quite a few graphs, quite a few sets of data where they were looking at a absenteeism in a metalworking plant. And that is also backed up by interviews that they did with people. So I think it's going to be very useful for us to discuss, because there's many things that Mayo talks about that we, as Dimitris pointed out, wouldn't really consider controversial today, but back in his time, people were really focused on more on technical issues and not on, not as much on what we would call social or human relations. So that's, I think, a lot of what we're going to talk about today.
A fun fact about this text is that, coming to what you said about him perhaps attempting to popularize his work, is that he was actually encouraged to write this by a professor at Harvard, Wallace Dunham. So the first book was as it was supposed to be, and then they thought it's worth pulling the remainder of combined Hawthorne papers into a single volume, and this was it. And reading from the introduction where Mayo outlines this, it seems that perhaps he wasn't too eager to do this at first, but committed to not one but two books in addition to the first one, the last being Political Problems of Industrial Civilization,
which he does hint at or address periodically in the book. So you can see that's where he's going to go.
I just would like actually to build on what you said and what Dimitri said, so just tag along. I think that was very interesting on what you both guys highlighted, is that there is something related to the approach that he's using, which we can describe as a very inductive. You know, he's, in a way, you know, using a very fieldwork-oriented kind of research, which is very different from the people from Carnegie Mellon, which is much more about formal models, very different from people like Bernard or Taylor, who are really relying on their own experience, but is really doing like empirical research and going out there in the field and seeing things how they happen in organizations, which is very interesting. And as you said, and we were talking about the whole initial study about the lighting and so on, they set up to study how comfort would impact the productivity of the worker, but then they discovered, and that's the important word here, how much informal groups and social relations had an impact on the way that work was carried out, which was exactly a field discovery. And it set up the opening for a whole range of different ways of thinking about work welfare and so on and so forth. And just two things on what you said as well. It's very interesting how much he is has this very strong critique of economics and this more cognitive approach, and is very much showing how much social relations goes on into the way work is organized, because thus far everyone was talking about the worker as this very individual based, performance oriented, only looking about benefits and thinking about money kind of person. Not necessarily Bernard, but you know, most of the literature thus far. And he opens up a new stream, which is very interesting.
Bernard has his own very peculiar approach to thinking and talking about individuals, both in them being alone and as part of groups.
Just to build on what Pedro said, Mayo is calling for a more scientific approach to social science, and he criticizes the lack of that, and he actually gives some examples of how he thinks it ought to be done. And I think that's something we're going to find enjoyable to talk about, and I think our listeners will find very interesting, because this is one of the first texts where you actually get into a writer who's talking about how they think social science should be done.
Yes.
So that's the entire first part, I think you're referring to.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. So let's start off talking about the book. So it's interesting. Like Bernard, Mayo spends the first several chapters and the first part of the book setting up what he wants to talk about, setting up why it's important to approach social relations as important in the workplace. And that's why he calls the first part of the book the seamy side of progress. Mm-hmm. And he talks about disorganization and how in the technological age people don't know each other. And so this idea of having deep expertise and learning social relations as part of the job, they get split. And that the focus on technical detail, right? So you can hear sort of Taylorism in the background. And I'm not criticizing Taylorism. It's just, you can see that's kind of what he's talking about, is this strict focus on the technical details of the work basically stripped out the social aspects of it. Mm-hmm. And then Mayo says that the consequence is that you cannot assume cooperation is going to happen automatically. And so he echoes Bernard, and there's quite a bit of overlap between him and Bernard, which I found very, very interesting. And that you have to actually understand what motivates people socially. And then it gets into the parts about the group dynamics, which you can talk about later. But I just thought that was interesting that he does this whole setup about how society is on this wrong track because we basically have produced a bunch of managers who are technical only and don't seem to think that there's much benefit in understanding what motivates people.
I actually had mixed feelings, I think, regarding this part because, well, for one, I was expecting the book to be more like a report about the different studies, but actually has all this very philosophical discussion at the beginning. And although I find interesting some of the things he says there, I feel that somehow there seems to be some exaggerating points.
Exaggeration. Yeah, I agree. Exaggeration. I agree. He is really, I mean, I had some comments where I put, and we can talk about them later when we get to them, but why basically sweeping statements and condemnations of society and political science and legal and all those kinds of things. And I realize he's trying to set up his points later, but I don't think it really helps him. I think he's much better when he gets in the later part of the books and he actually starts talking about the data and the interviews that he did. So yes. I was a little disappointed in that part as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, the reason they're sweeping is because he is basically recounting Marx and many of such criticisms also present in Thoreau about technology and society. So this has been going on since the dawn of civilization, where preceding generation would complain about life speeding up and people being out of touch with nature. Exactly. And
you're sort of
thing. And reading this, I couldn't stop smiling or laughing, not in a condescending way, but just in delight, because these are important points, and I agree that they're completely out of place for Mayo, because his rendition is not convincing and a bit besides the...
Exactly.
He's missing the mark.
Exactly.
Quite
That's
a lot, basically. But to supplement this via our podcast, I'll just give a brief summary of what his point of contention is. And basically, he's saying that in the good old days, people would spend a significant proportion of their life locally, where they would be born, and engaging in traditional ways of producing their livelihood. So you would have fishermen, you'd have farmers, you'd have various artisans and merchants and whatnot, and those people would practice their craft and they would live in communities where everyone would know everyone, or at least most people, and they would have social skills that have a connection to fellow human being as well as skill in their particular work. And for instance, fishermen in one place would be significantly different from someone living in a landlocked country, for instance. And then with the industrialization and people moving to large population centers to pursue factory work, so pretty much just a few decades before he wrote this, what happened was that all these people, they uproot their living, their existence, they leave their communities, and they concentrate in these lifeless centers where everyone comes to do things they are disconnected from, which primarily was production line work and such. And they don't own the means of production, they don't own the results of their labor. And because of that, according to this line of inquiry, they begin to, I don't know, they lose spiritual essence that makes them who they are. So because of that, there's no social skills, there's no communities. Everyone's kind of just trotting along to factories and earning a living, if you can stretch that. Not the earning bit, but the living part. And for Mayo and other such thinkers, the civilization is becoming sterile and gray, and people are losing touch with what's important. So interestingly, he suggests that education and what we now refer to as STEM, so science, technology, engineering and mathematics, is insufficient without a healthy dose of at least sociology, but ideally philosophy on his account. And I found that very interesting, because now we seem to have something of an inverted discourse going on, that there are too many arts majors and we need more STEM people.
Yes, yes, the pendulum is swinging back.
Yes, I think he argued for a balance. So, you know, you're doing engineering and you take a course in, I don't know, psychology 101 or something. But yeah, it seems more of a pendulum thing.
I don't think necessarily that he's proposing more courses on there, but he talks about something like a social skill, and he actually talks about things that go beyond just the formal education. So I don't really think that would be, you know, a class on something, but more, he talks about the ability to communicate, for instance, as an example of the social skill, which is a bit vague. But what I see that he's trying to say is that exactly is the ability, what he calls, to cooperate with each other in a way, which for me is weird, because, I don't know, when you think about professional schools, like an engineering school, there is a lot that goes into creating socialization of the newcomers and all kinds of societies that goes on, and all kinds of, you know, exercises like teamwork and role play, in which people learn these things, you know. So it's a bit weird to think of, you know, education as only this indoctrination of ideas.
Well, he doesn't suggest that people do not communicate in this industrial age. I think his point is more related to what I said about community, that they do not communicate in a meaningful way. So it's
yes, true.
It's information versus that you know someone and you touch their soul, mm-hmm. and you can share things, and you actually have the ability and capability to have a deep, yeah. meaningful conversation with a fellow human being, and not just share information.
I see your point.
So much of the first part of the book is him trying to level this critique at society of 1930s.
Yeah, modern America. Life at the time.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this goes on for quite a while, like I think 50-something pages. So having listened to the podcast up until this point, you can skip that, I think.
yes, because I think Demetrius, you gave a very good summary of his main critique of society, and he basically quotes H.G. Wells and talking about these communities that are all dispirited and disorganized. I'm not quite sure what he means by, you know, disorganized, but I think it relates back to that broader sense you were talking about, as people knew each other and they had the sense of community spirit, and a lot of the stuff that I think people took for granted, ability to cooperate with your neighbors. Mm-hmm. And I think he's also put in pretty stark terms, like you suggested, Demetrius, where it's well, we used to have this idyllic age maybe 40 years ago, and now it's just chaos and disorganization. Because you can remember, he's writing at the time of Hitler and Mussolini and World War, and so I could see why somebody would find that depressing.
Yeah. But then he goes into an interesting, I would say, setup that actually helps his argument later, which is his critique of the idea of what kind of man is the one that is assumed in traditional economic scholarship.
Oh, absolutely.
Do you want to say more about that?
Yes. So what I understand is he goes to great lengths to prove that the whole idea of Hobbes and all the others that, you know, you need to have a big state to control the individuals and so on and so forth is actually a fiction. You know, that there is no such a thing as a person that does not belong or does not have any social relation. By the single fact that you use a language, it just means that you carry an institution. You are already part of a group. So he tries to deconstruct this idea that we have from economics and all other disciplines as well. There is this thing like the individual as a machine that's only looking to augment and increase, you know, his pleasure and avoid other things, negative things, to show that.
And not only that, that they're essentially focused on only self-interest, yes. Right? That's one of the things he deconstructs. Mm-hmm. And that he refers to, you get this disorganized rabble is what he terms that sort of model of man, which I thought was fascinating. I'm sorry.
No. Thank you. And what is interesting that he's showcased and proves that this is actually, it can be expected in extreme cases or in abnormal psychology cases in which a person will only think about himself or herself. But actually, in normal life, people are going to follow traditions and rules, and they're going to have relations to other people.
Right. Well, and not only does he say that, but he also criticizes the whole way, mm-hmm. the whole mechanism that Ricardo and Hobbes used to come up with these theories. And he basically said, look, this modern sociology or sociology of the day mm-hmm. is essentially being trained to write about other people's books.
Yes.
That they don't get out of the lab. And generating this knowledge of acquaintance. He has this great line on page 20. He says that sociology is an exercise in the acquisition of scholarship. Students are taught to write books about each other's books. Whoa, that's quite the put down. And I can't help but think we have a little bit of that going on today. If you read some of the management journals and you sometimes wonder, all right, who are these people talking to? Does anybody in business really even, you know, find any value in some of this research? And I know we can go in a whole, you know, whole different direction that way, but I do think some of that criticism is still valid today.
I think it's a bit hypocritical of him, though, because one of the main criticisms he has towards his field of study is that it's not patient enough. He talks about how physics and chemistry started off humble and then proceeded incrementally over the ages to the natural sciences with a decent degree of predictability that they are now. Mm-hmm. And he seems to want the same from management, but the way to achieve that is to write commentaries on commentaries and incrementally distill insights and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting that he would have a problem with this.
No, but I think the difference is that he's saying that instead of just, you know, he has this idea of the clinic and the laboratory. You know, the clinic being exactly doing field study, being out there and see how things happen. And that's the difference, you know. It's okay to rely on books, but he's saying that we ought to get more out there and see what's going on, doing field studies. So I think that's what he's trying to say.
Yeah, I think it's a mix is what he's looking for.
Yeah, but there was another thing I wanted to expand on what Ralph said about this idea of knowledge. Because what I see there is almost like the birth of one idea that we have very much today, which is the idea that knowledge is not only a cognition, something that goes, you know, in the brain, but it's actually something that is a practice, that's something that's relational, that is done with other people, and so on and so forth, which is, he calls about knowledge of acquaintance. Or you can even say, you know, ideas like tacit knowledge that came much later. It's interesting, I have a sentence here that I note down that I really much like, that it says, knowledge derived from experience is hard to transmit, except by example, imitation, and trial and error. And then he compares that with erudition. You know, these are all ideas that are very common on the whole discussions on knowledge management and learning and organizational learning.
Yeah, I agree with you. I thought as soon as I read that section, I was thinking, oh, he's talking about tacit knowledge there. It's just that Pogliani hasn't come along yet.
Whom we will discuss in half a dozen episodes or so, I think.
Yes, I think that'll be very good. One more thing about the, you know, generating knowledge. So he does make a comment on page 19 about observation, skill, experiment, and logic, that these must be regarded as the three stages of advancement. So that's I think, the punctuation mark to what you were saying, Demetrius, where he was talking about this sort of incremental advance. And his, I guess, so I don't know if he's saying, you know, you can't be writing books about books or that there's no knowledge can be generated that way. But for him, the observation comes first. That's what I think is essential, because when he's really dismissing Ricardo and Hobbes, he's saying, you know, Ricardo went off into the country and wrote this book, and how does that have any relation to what he observed? Or, you know, he was dismissive of the principles that came out of that. And I think he's making a really good point about sociology and, you know, management studies, where you have to actually get down there and see what people are doing.
So let's get down there and see what people did.
Okay, so go ahead.
So a brief intro to the second part of the book is, it's basically four case studies over about 20 years. And an interesting part of that is that they are largely unedited from their original publications. So this allows you and us to see how the thinking progressed between 1923 and whenever the last one was. And the first case study is on what was the place? Textile plant.
Textile plant in New England.
In Philadelphia.
Yep.
The second one is on...
wasn't it the Hawthorne, the interviews in the Hawthorne room?
Or, I think so. Yeah, the second one is on the famous that Ralph mentioned on the lighting changes.
Yes.
And then the other two studies mainly cover absenteeism in two war plants.
Well, right. And so what I think is the textile plant, he gives a lot of good data in there about works and breaks and it's sort of a narrative of, okay, we tried these things. We looked at trying to manipulate some of these variables. And very early, he talks about the role that the plant manager, I don't think he was the owner of the company. It was the colonel he's referred to as, who helped, I would say, convince the managers who thought all this was a waste of time, you know, to keep going and actually make these commitments to the workers to give them more autonomy. And one of the things I thought was very interesting that, and Mayo said it was unexpected, was that work relations improved in parts of the plant where they weren't actually studying. And he surmised that was because the workers were talking amongst each other and knew that, oh, okay, if they're trying this stuff, they're going to probably try something else in our area. So I know it's not good data, but I thought it was interesting that just to make the observation that things changed in other parts of the plant that they actually weren't making these manipulations.
And the main crux of manipulations was adjusting the duration and frequency of rest periods.
Yes, and it was two pieces, right? So it was frequency and duration of rest periods, and then giving workers a say. Because they kind of, originally it was just, okay, we're going to try these different rests. And then they found out, well, if we could talk to workers and let them arrange their rest periods, that seemed to make an even bigger difference. And that's where the light bulb starts going on for Mayo and others and says, hey, the you have to give the workers some level of autonomy and some level of input. They just treat them like robots is not going to be effective.
And is that there's something that he comments that he was not aware when he did this study, but he became aware after, which is that in a way, by empowering the workers, which is pretty much what we're saying here, is that they, before they had a very individual, I mean, there was no sense of team among them because they work in a very isolated thing, but since they had to come together to decide who is going to take a rest, they started to see themselves more of a team. And that, you know, it's one of the core insights there.
Yes, this is summarized on page 67, where I'm not quite sure whether that's a metaphor or an actual location, but he says that in May 1924, he, that being the president of the textile plant, placed the control of rest periods squarely in the hands of the workers in an alley with no one to say them nay. So I don't know if alley is an actual, that they would kick them out into the alley to rest, or it means something else, but this is basically what Pedger just mentioned, that they would get to come together to decide things, thus introducing a sense of camaraderie and a bit of social comfort into the mm-hmm. otherwise solitaire, which, as he calls it, lifestyle.
Right, and Mayo points out that the side effect or the additional benefit that nobody really saw coming was that this cooperation among the workers led to cooperation in other kinds of work, and they basically had increased feelings of responsibility among the workers, which raised their morale, improved productivity, had all these extra benefits.
Not just work. He gives an example of this one guy who stopped drinking as much and started taking his wife out to the cinema on the weekends as a result of their interference, of Mayo's interference with the textile plant.
There is another...
Yeah, so it was interesting. It extends to his private life as well. Yeah.
No, I was just going to say that there's another interesting aspect that he says that before all these changes, these workers never managed to get the monthly bonus. They never managed to reach or exceed the quota. So they never... And once these were implemented, they outperformed. And the point is interesting here is that, well, there was already in theory incentive system, but they never really, you know, followed through because there were other things on the way. So it's one grain that brings the idea that exactly just economic incentive is not enough for the workers. And I cannot help but to feel some resemblance and at least reminiscence of the whole idea from Maslow that we discussed some podcasts ago. You know, like the idea of, you know, self-esteem and, you know, all these like things that go beyond. Oh, and interesting, also the physiological aspect of it that Maslow talks about, so having the time to rest in this case, which you know, until this far has not been very much discussed in the literature.
Yeah, so it makes you wonder, was it just the physical rest that they were getting, or the fact that they had a say in it? And I think Mayo would come down the side of the latter, that the you know, the rest might have made some difference, but the overriding issue was the fact that they were consulted and they had some input and could talk, you know, work it out amongst themselves.
I think the overriding issue is that they were allowed to do that in a group.
Completely agree. So any more we want to talk about that before we go on to the Hawthorne and Western Electric comments from the interview experiment?
I guess we can mention that, interestingly, all these realizations did not dawn on Mayo and his colleagues at the time of performing that research, and that they were simply largely puzzled by why and what is having such effects on not only on the study group, but also, as you mentioned, in the broader organization and outside of it, in the private domain.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes that, here are these great insights about groups and about rest and about degree of delegation that occurred, but we didn't quite understand at the time and we moved on to do other things. And I think this is a very realistic description of how any kind of research work, not just academic, also commercial, progresses, that you are very likely to find things that don't make sense, but kind of still explain them away and only later recognize the true value or the true cause-effect relationships that may have been at play there.
Although I have to say that we can discuss that when we talk about the Hawthorne studies per se, but somehow I felt, you know, that the analysis I expected from him fell short, because he describes a lot of things and he hints that they are created. No, they are a function of social relations and the group, but I think that sometimes it's just a box for him. You know, I think a lot can be ascribed to that he doesn't unpack so much, but maybe we can talk about that when we discuss the Hawthorne studies.
Pedro, I think you're right. In the first study, that is the way he kind of covers it, but then he broadens or deepens that box in the Hawthorne studies, as we'll talk about.
I think that's because he's a naturalist, and I don't necessarily mean that in a negative way, but how he was describing his vision and his aspiration for social sciences very much suggests that he just lacked the vocabulary and the toolbox to prove these rigid cause-effect relationships within the social realm, which we now accept as simply the way it is, and the social elements of science are significantly different from natural ones, not least because they understand what's going on and can adjust their behavior accordingly. So I think if you don't seem impressed.
No, I agree with that, but I think that
that was a dubious. That was a dubious sound.
Yes.
No. No. I don't mean it that way. I'm just saying that accounts for part of it. But there is, for instance, the fact that I know for someone that talks a lot about social skills and sociology and so on and so forth, the interventions that he does at the end of the day doesn't bring so much, you know, like the whole toolbox of social sciences. I was expecting him, for instance, to think more about the division of work or how kind of workspace do they have, you know, not so much, oh, we're going to give them rest periods, you see?
But I think, Peter, what you're seeing, or what we're seeing in the book, is he's learning that. The team is learning that. Through the case studies, okay. I think he's describing an evolution in the way they're thinking, because I agree with Demetrius that he didn't really realize all these things he's writing about the time they were doing the study. They were just puzzled. And then later, he looks at this in light of the many hundreds of interviews and situations and cases that they've done. He sort of alludes to in the book, but he says he didn't include. So I agree with you that they're not doing that, but I think that's because they just came in and said, well, how do we fix this productivity area? How do we do something about this? And they're looking at more for the from the sort of Taylorism of what interventions do we have to take. And I think they learned about those social things as they went along. That's the impression I got from reading the chapter.
Yeah. No, I think I'm a bit impatient. That's why.
Fair enough. Okay. Yes, I thought the same thing when they were writing about the how the people felt, you know, when they basically took away their autonomy or their, some of their input and productivity went into the very low levels. And I felt like saying, well, what did you think was going to happen after you gave people this autonomy and you took it away? Yeah. I was impatient as well. And I thought, okay, wait, dude, I'm sure they're going to cover that later.
Yeah. On Mayo's defense, I just want to say one thing. I was actually impressed with the fact that he was telling the story that, you know, the company approached academia. Well, it was not the first people that they approached, but they ended up approaching academics and how much they suggested interventions and were doing research at the same time. And that resembles a lot like action research, you know, and it's very interesting today that we have all this discussion about impact and so on and so forth to read these accounts and see, whoa, that's incredible how much collaboration there was, you know, between academia and industry back then.
Oh, absolutely. So I want to digress just a little bit. I'll give you a work story that I think relates to this, giving people more control and autonomy and taking it away, maybe, you know, giving it back. So I was in a work situation once where I was catching a lot of negative feedback or criticism from superiors about performance of the work groups that were working with me. And so I went to the managers and I said, okay, I'm going to decide now how we run things. And I'm going to decide what some of these detailed procedures are that they used to have autonomy for. And because it was a military circumstance, everybody, you know, followed orders directly, but you could tell there was a little bit of discontent because I disempowered the managers. And then they came back to me and they said, we want to have control back. And I said, as soon as you make a proposal to me about how you're going to do things differently, other than just saying, we want to have control, then you can have control back. But I'm not getting it back to you just because you said we want to have control. So you come back and talk to me about how you're going to make a difference and what changes you're going to put in place. And you could make the argument that none, it needs to be none, but I want to hear what your justification is for that. So they, I guess they originally thought I was just going to push a button and say, okay, you guys go back to doing it. You know, you've been in the penalty box, as they say in hockey, long enough, and now you'll come back out. And I think I surprised them when I said, no, you're going to have to explain to me what you're going to do differently. And so then they went away and then came back and said, here's the things that we're going to go do differently. And here's how we're going to monitor things. And I said, great, go get them. You know, now I don't need to run things because I now can see you guys are going to do stuff. Because I just can't. I said, look, I just can't go to my superiors and say, well, we want to be left alone. It doesn't work that way. And so there's an example of it. I don't know if that's exactly the point, but it felt like it'd be fun to tell.
No, I like it.
No, nonetheless, it's a good example. And I can testify that I had exact same in principle experience in some of my work as well. So it must be true.
Oh, there you go.
We had two academics agreeing, so it must be true.
Yeah, exactly.
I just want to point out that maybe it's something that we are going to talk more later again, but this resembles a lot contemporary discussions on team-level control or, you know, empowering teams to put on their own metrics to one member control each other, and the whole discussion that exists on coercive control, which is exactly, you know, I think about Lean, for instance, and how much the work cells in a manufacturing plant have their own metrics and they have their own goals that they must achieve. And the workers themselves are the ones, you know, policing, if you will, the members of the work cell to be sure that they hit that target. You know, there is no need necessarily for someone outside to do that because they want to get that goal for a number of reasons. And then themselves are doing the controlling and keeping tracking of that, which is interesting because it turns Taylor upside down almost.
Oh, absolutely.
Instead of, you know, dividing up the work and controlling person by person, we actually empower them, create this, you know, like group of work and let themselves to take care of their outputs.
Well, it's the famous dichotomy coming up again, isn't it? That you can either have more certainty in the case with Taylor, or you can try something like this. And Mayo does show that it's not as easy as, okay, you guys come up with your own stuff and do things as you wish in terms of effort, material, and time durations, that this can also go terribly wrong, terribly quick.
Yeah. But what I think wanna highlight is that management in these contemporary discussions, like Lean, for instance, that I was referring, the manager set up the structure in a way that, you know, the group has very standardized how we're going to do that, you know, but then he can abstract himself from the whole daily control. That's the point.
Well, and I think that's, Peter, that's a good lead into the Hawthorne interview studies in chapter four, mm-hmm. because he talks about what the sort of the optimum working conditions of human beings. And if you leave it to dogma and traditions, right, or worse, guess or quasi-philosophical argument, this is, and I'm kind of quoting Mayo now, that mm-hmm. you don't get optimum output that way. And then he talks about, it echoes, I think, a little bit, but goes beyond Bernard. And he talks about the large-scale industry, that there's three persistent problems of management. You know, you want to have, and I think you were talking about balance, right? You want to have the application of science and technical skill, because it's important to producing the goods in a modern industrial setting. And then I think the mm-hmm. thing that you were just talking about, I would just paraphrase it slightly. The last thing you finished up talking about was systematic ordering of the operation, right? That's sort of the lean thinking is, all right, what am I trying to mm-hmm. accomplish? What are my goals, right? So I thought mm-hmm. I thought Mayo stated that very, very well. He talked about the systematic ordering of operation. And then there's the part that basically were Taylorism and Fayol and a lot of others, and I'm not criticizing, it's just what they were thinking about at the time. I mean, mm-hmm. now we would criticize it, where the third piece is essential, and that is the organization of teamwork, or what Bernard and both Mayo called sustained cooperation, right? Because, yeah. you know, one of the things that drove Taylor crazy was what he called soldiering, you know, where workers would, you know, get together and reduce productivity to maintain some sort of group control. And I've actually been on the receiving end of some of that myself. And there's, you know, you can rant all you want to, but you can't fix it, right? You can't just tell people to speed up on certain things. It does a particular technical work, right? So they really do have the upper hand, and you really do need to give them more autonomy and control, because they will bring you to your knees by working like strictly to the rules of the dogma, you know, that kind of thing. So I think that's, Mayo is having, it's a nice intro to the chapter where he talks about these important concerns of management, and that we're not paying enough attention to that third part of it, which is the organization of teamwork.
And he kind of correlates these to Bernard's work, saying that the first two that you mentioned about the science and the systematic ordering are akin to what Bernard referred to as effective operations.
Yes, there's great overlap there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, he actually says that in the paragraph after the list. And effective had to do with the goals of the organization. But the third one, the teamwork bit, it has to do with efficiency in Bernard's lingo, which, as you recall, has to do with job satisfaction. And Mayo mm-hmm. attests right. that this is a frequently ignored area in management and organizations.
Right. I mean, I went back and looked that up from our Bernard studies, just because it's a little different than the way we talk about it now. Sometimes I have to remind myself that when Bernard was talking about efficient, he means how well it satisfies individual motives, which is mm-hmm. not the way we commonly think of efficiency. I think Bernard's correct, but that is not the common way we think of it.
I think it's burned into my mind now, especially having done the summary.
So many hours of discussion, yes.
And that's all for part one of episode 9. Thank you for listening. Please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com for information on what's to follow, future episodes, and for our blog. Also, we have just started a photo gallery on our website, where we intend to publish various podcast around the world pictures. Go to our Facebook feed for more information on that, and for how to get involved if you wish to. If you're enjoying our discussion of Elton Mayo thus far, please leave us a positive review on iTunes, even a brief one can go a long way to help new listeners find us there. Subscribe to our feed and tell your friends and colleagues about this podcast. You can also get in touch with us on our website, Twitter, Facebook, and on LinkedIn. Thank you, and we hope to see you next week as we conclude our discussion of the social problems of an industrial civilization, which is part of the famous Hawthorne studies, here on Talking About Organizations.